You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome to Hugo and Greg. Hugo is a Berkman Center Fellow this year and at the Graduate School of Design, and Greg is a student at the MIT Media Lab. They've both been building protocol, and they're going to talk to us about the communication crises and the evolution of personal and cultural protocols. So welcome, guys.
Thanks, Homer.
Thanks.
So thank you very much, everyone, for coming today in the rain. We wanted to build on the earlier talk that I gave in a Berkman Fellow Hour and share more about this tool that we've been beta testing and we'll launch more broadly this week with some new features in the coming months. And so so I want to show you a quick video just of the state of the problem that we are trying to solve. I'm not plugging sound. So I'll stop the video on Ashton Kutcher because that's when it gets more popular. But it's worth looking at this video, which was made by Jess3, one of the very renowned design and information design agencies in the world. It speaks to this crisis that we alluded to today, that it's just the number of channels are exploding and the messages that we exchange between them is increasing. This is a graphic from a blog post on the blog, the 99%, just to show someone literally drowning in the different options of communication. And so we worked on a tool for that. So this communication crisis, we have too many messages, too much noise, and too much guilt. And part of what brought Greg and I together, Greg is a researcher at MIT working to make technology more human, is the human component of this. There are many people working to solve the technical problem, but we were interested in how we deal with the guilt and how it affected our feeling of integrity, and how we could both build the technology as well as maybe look at behavior to solve this problem.
So you've got a lot of examples like Inbox Zero, getting things done, all these sort of tools to try to handle that feeling of being overwhelmed, the ideas of email bankruptcy and having to declare that at some point where you just let them all go and you start over, all of these sort of ideas that try to prevent us from feeling like we've got this information overload happening.
So I mentioned this before, and people like this image so much, but there's a lot of numbers, and I can throw numbers at you guys, and I think you guys know that oftentimes better than we do, but what better way to illustrate the problem and the big missing link than this SKCD cartoon made by Russell Munroe? So it's very familiar, I'm sure, to all of you in the room, but he made one almost 5 years ago, and it was the shape of the internet. And if you zoom in, there was Usenet, and Usenet was our experience of email, right? And I'm not going to ask who in the room used Usenet, but I'm sure there are many people that proudly still maybe use it. And that was email, and that was communication at a massive scale. More recently, the updated online community in 2010 was again very famous, and people commented a lot on QQ, which is this really big Chinese, blogging site and traffic site, and Ethan can speak more to that. And then Facebook Farmville, Happy Farm, all the games. But what people may not have noticed, the nuance that he put in very insightfully in this cartoon, is the fact that the internet is morphed by email, SMS, and cell phones. And then on the left-hand sketch, spoken language. And so even though we have a lot of dialogue and we develop tools to have information brought to us through RSS feeds or Twitter is now replacing that need. We haven't yet figured out how to dabble between spoken cell phones and then all these different tools on the internet to communicate. So there's been a flurry of media in the last month, but over the last 6 months about this. And many of you might have seen the New York Times story, Don't Call Me, I Won't Call You, only a month or so ago. And I won't read you from the quote. So basically, it cataloged how people are opting not to use phones, and how some people are completely flabbergasted when someone calls them out of the blue and expects them to pick up.
And so the last line is really interesting, the sort of, I'm missing the phone, it's warmer and more honest. And that's very true in a lot of senses, in that voice is very effective at conveying things like emotion, confidence, how nervous you are, sentiment, all these really, really nice cues that you don't get from text. However, that communication channel isn't appropriate for everything that we're doing. And so, you know, when you pass the wrong information along that voice channel, all of those nice cues become very useless. If I get called at 9 a.m. in the morning, you know, by a client or something like that, and I'm asleep, none of that stuff really matters to me. The fact that this guy is feeling good and that I'm happy about all these voice things, a text message or an email would have been much more appropriate at that time for me personally.
Exactly. And then only 2 days ago, keep your thumb still when I'm talking to you. And this is basically two friends who write for TechCrunch, but also for the New York Times, going back and forth in all these various forums, discussing if it's okay or not to use your phone and where social norms will be going. And so Siegler wrote, you know, it's going to be dinner 2.0, and you know, I will be using my phone at the table. It's an augmented experience, and the question is not if I can or not. The question is, will the tables be adapted to charge my phone and have a seamless experience at dinner, was his sort of baseline assumption. And then other folks said, if you touch your phone when we're speaking, I will walk away. And so we're interested in to hear what your experiences are and your rules are, but there's obviously a generational component to this. This obviously, you know, looking at works like Being Digital or Born Digital, you know, when you were born, what tools you became familiarized with, and also the context you work in. I've noticed when I go to MIT or to Palo Alto, there's a lot more phone action than if I'm, you know, in some other place on this campus, perhaps, where people, where there's a different context. For example, I'll call out the GSD. The design school is definitely a place where people do email at a desktop environment, and not in an in-person environment. So I won't delve too deeply into this, but I think you're all familiar with, and I'm going to reference David Weinberger's review of Sherry Turkle's book later. But basically, the internet, as David said, is this personal, test of, you know, are you for, where do you think the internet will go, and are you excited about where it's taking us or not? It is as David said, a Rorschach test. And so a friend of mine commented that it's kind of like in the Cold War with the MAD Treaty, where you have a mutually assured distraction. And so we build up all these tools, and this is one example of Gmail making priority inbox. But I'm sure many of you have used or looked at Zopni, and you all have your own tools or your own methods that you've built to basically outsmart these other people that are constantly themselves trying to get better at reaching you. And so there's this very, I wouldn't use the word sick, but puzzling game happening. And in fact, recently a startup launched at Y Combinator that turned email into a game, and it literally tried to train people, young people, to treat email as a game so they're more proficient at it, and so you can enjoy it. And there was a whole conference that sort of talked about inbox love that treated this very emotional topic. So we wanted to show you a few examples about how people deal with this currently, and at the end we'd love to hear how you deal with this big problem. So Dana Boyd.
So. You've got sort of these interesting behaviors happening where for a time, if you went on vacation and you had email, there was sort of, you got that autoresponder and it was expected, but you would still sort of email people and that was okay. It didn't build up too much. Then it started to get to the point where if you go on vacation, you literally get such a huge amount of information that you have to deal with when you get back that it may actually stress you out during the entire time you're on the vacation. And so then you get things like this that say, you know, basically, I'm not contactable while I'm on vacation. In fact, don't even email me. If you need to get a hold of me, like, here's my mother. Here's how to reach my mother to get a hold of me, because I don't want to have to declare email bankruptcy or deal with all this when I get back. And so another method is sort of these really funny what to do and what not to do. Basically, these like homemade lists of, you know, communicating preferences. So here's what you should do before you email, like all these serious things. What not to do, I think a really interesting one is sending plain text, you know, PDF only if necessary. So you've got even these like technical requirements being fed into that cultural thing where you wouldn't have to do that on the phone, right? You wouldn't say, call me with this particular voice. You actually now have all these weird channels being combined. And this is sort of like a homemade recipe for cultural communication, which is really funny that this isn't sort of standardized yet, right? We're all sort of trying to figure combat out this idea.
And as a point of information, this is Tim Berners-Lee's actual webpage. So one of or the maker of the internet, depending on, or Al Gore's friend. But you know, this is the guy that has seen the whole evolution, and this is how he deals with the problem. And then on the more commercial side, you have people who who specify, you know, phones are very yesterday, voicemail is so broken. And, you know, if you look at many venture capitalists and especially faculty nowadays who are really busy and who are swarmed by students, have more and more of these rules. And in fact, Professor Harry Lewis suggested to me that this tool for him would be great if you could just, if he or his team organizing an academic conference could just know how to find someone. Because right now there's this hide-and-seek game where people have a publicly listed email on their institution or organization's website that goes to some managerial person that may or may not have direct access over them. And then this is, you know, they have a personal ad hoc mail at Gmail that they only give to friends, and a few weeks later they change it out, and it becomes a very long-winded conversation. So one big precedent that that originally got me thinking, and when Greg and I met, was revolved around five sentences, a quick design project that someone launched almost 2 years ago now. But when I saw this, it was like a light went on in my mind, and this, you know, a halo and this big voice from the clouds came. Because it struck me that if I put this email signature, and for those who can't see on the screen, there's a five sentences, a three sentences, and a I think a four sentences as well. And it's basically a pact. You put a signature in your email or in your other communications, and you say to the reader, I will only respond in three, four, or five sentences. And so it then removes a feeling of guilt that you may have, or it's a convenient excuse to have a very short and terse-ish reply. And when I saw this, I tried to use it, and the emotional conversations I had with people immediately saw the very long, famous Hugo emails being going down to three lines, made me, you know, think about the issue of integrity and of setting expectations, right? And good partnerships, good relationships, good projects all revolve around expectation management and expectation realization. And so we realized that a big issue here is not how well am I using Gmail. And I even put Gmail shortcut stickers on my keyboard so I could force myself to not use a mouse. But it's more the expectation setting that matters.
And the interesting thing about five sentences is that it's a really nice kernel, right? But it's not a generalized idea. It's sort of a single point which we can start to spin out into what is a better solution for this as a cultural solution, not just sort of this one attempt to shorten things up.
Right.
So, I mean, stop and go signaling is really funny, right? I mean, when you look at the evolution of how people view instant message, away messages, one is, it used to be you would write almost status messages. Like you had in Facebook Now, you had those as your away message, and it was your way to like sort of broadcast to the world what was going on. You had your profile for that kind of stuff. So your away message was almost not actually an away message, it was sort of a personal representation. Then it started to move into the point where away didn't actually mean, it was away from keyboard, right? So you actually weren't around, and that was okay, and you were gone. Now away tends to mean a little bit like I'm busy, or I'm probably here, and you might be able to contact me if you're the right person, but it's sort of, and then there's an invisible, right? So now I need to be able to sort of voyeuristically spy on the people that are around in case I need to get a hold of somebody, but I need to pull back from that.
And so we wanted to amplify that existing sort of understanding. And then I didn't just dig this up for archival research. I actually wrote something about this in college and in a history class, and the evolution of manners and protocol and customs in the Commonwealth, specifically the British Commonwealth. And so this is a poster from Australia, but I looked originally at similar ones in South Africa, and I'm sure some made their way to Canada, I'm sure. But basically, there was this notion when Baden-Powell made the Boy Scouts and then all that, and the Eagle Scouts in the States, of essentially priming behavior and sort of having a meeting and saying, this is our expected community norms, and can we signal that? And if we collectively agree to those, will that lead to a different community? And we all know that that now happens informally in organizations through leadership or through a conversation up front when a project is kicked off. But nevertheless, it struck me that we had posters back in the day we put up at schools and in meeting places that instructed this mode of behavior. And today, there's no singular voice. And I'm not saying there should be. I would like to have a personal one. But it's nevertheless an interesting precedent that has fallen on the wayside.
It's interesting to think about whether there were any children actually involved with the Children's National Guild of Courtesy.
Probably not.
I just find myself wondering whether the management team of that guild included any actual children.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a great point, because for rules like this to work, or rules for ideas, protocols, community standards to work, people need to own them, right? And so I've definitely noticed, to give you a simple example, in my courses at the business school, at FAS or at MIT, if the teacher does a good job, and different institutions have different requirements for this, of setting expectations up front of how a conversation will occur, of whether or not there are name tags or not, it definitely breeds a different environment in that space. But only if it is it's mutually agreed on, right? And that's the key insight. And so I won't go too deeply into this, but a lot of research that we can talk about later. And Greg is very humble. He's actually helped build many of the tools that I'm sure you guys use, from getting things done to the action method. But there's a lot of research. There's a lot of academic research. There's a lot of thinking around batch processing of email. And there's a lot of more mainstream solutions like Zalpney, I mentioned earlier, that people use in industry. But all of this really condensed down, comes down to three steps, we believe, that sort of to tackle this problem. One is just to define your rules of engagement. And this is a no-brainer, but we'd like to have people take a moment and to think about that. And to not only think about what they would like it to be, but to realize what it actually is and what it has been and what are the reasons for that. And then step two is to organize a system to execute on your rules. And so to actually commit to publicly having that system and sticking with it. And then finally having an easy sort of way where there's a third-party service almost, you know, like the five sentences example, where you can share your rules and set those expectations and then keep them. So we'd like to show you a quick demo for those of you who've not seen this yet. We're going to open it up later this week. So we're going to do a quick sign-up for those who have not seen it before. Thanks. Yeah. There we go. That's big enough. So I logged out again. So you go to protocol.by, and do you know as I click? And so at this point, we still only have the Gmail login. I know many of you have mentioned you don't trust Google as much as you trust yourself, which I understand, but we definitely will expand it later.
So we should probably preface what protocol is before we actually sign up for it. So the idea with protocol is sort of taking all these ideas of personally how to communicate my preferences, building on something sort of bigger than five sentences, pulling all these getting things done, getting rid of guilt. How do we create enough context and enough information that these things can be useful? So a good example is sort of an interesting example is sort of Google's Priority Inbox, which tries to automatically sort all this stuff for you. But let's face it, it knows very little about you. I mean, Google doesn't actually know when I wake up, how my things go, what I like to do at a bar versus a restaurant versus when I'm in a meeting place like this. All that sort of nice information isn't anywhere. And there's even Grand Central Station, or Grand Central that they had a long time ago, which now became Google Voice, where they would try to sort of intelligently route your calls into the right device. But they would do this just sort of based on very broad rules that really didn't have any sort of context around them that made it useful. And so protocol is this attempt to actually capture that rich information in a way that we can then start to expose it to people and to devices that allow them to find us better, understand us better. Even at a very basic level, you know, just how I like to be contacted and the rules around those preferences is a great start. And then, you know, eventually expanding into where I am at the time and how those preferences happen. So we'll show you a concrete example in a minute, but we're actually just sort of signing up.
Yeah. And so done with that.
Okay, so we've signed up. That's essentially the entire sign-up process. So if you guys want to go get a protocol profile right now, it's about that easy. And then we can head over to actually my profile. Yeah. So basically what makes a protocol is a series of channels you like in the order that you prefer them, and then sort of some custom rules around those profiles, as well as things you don't respond to. So for me, I'd say I sort of fall into like the technophile generation where phone is the last thing for me. In fact, my phone says don't call before noon and don't expect me to answer. So this is a very, like, I don't want to offend people. I don't want them to feel bad that I'm not picking up my phone. It's not a personal thing. My voicemail actually now says, hi, please send me an email at this address. And it's just because it's not the most efficient communication channel for me. It's going to take me a long time to get back to you. And it's better to set up that expectation up front that, look, I'm not being rude. This is just what I prefer. The nice thing also about email, I don't know if you guys can see on there, but it says, short and sweet, no intros, sign-offs needed. That idea that sort of you can email me without saying, hey, Greg, how are you doing? How was that concert you went to last weekend, right? You can actually just say, hey, you were supposed to send me that document. Where is it, right? I won't be offended by that. In fact, you'll probably get a response much quicker from me. And I know that's a personal thing, that I don't use email as a way to sort of socially garden. Sorry.
Sure. Maybe you don't want to share, but why don't you like the phone, really?
I do like the phone for my family and my friends and for catching up. I like it for client meetings that require lots of people, okay. And there's lots of information to delve into. But I'd say 80% of my communication are tasks that need to be done, setting up events, setting up a schedule, trying to figure out what to work on next, right? And that's sort of like very iterative things versus tomorrow I need to have a call with all of these people. We need to figure out a budget. We need to figure out a financial situation. That's a perfect opportunity for a phone call.
Okay.
So there, I think that's the idea that there are different uses, and what are those uses? And how these are all just sort of in the ether right now. And the fact that you had to ask me personally to find this out, you know, this isn't represented anywhere. It's implicit knowledge that's sort of just floating around. If you know me, you'll know that. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. And we can talk more about that, but it's also worth noting that, you know, the way that Greg chooses to communicate is his personal preference, right? And so one thing we've noticed as we have people sign up is the younger students who may not feel as accomplished yet, even though they transact a lot of emails every day, feel that, you know, it's almost rude to have a protocol like this. Some of them have mentioned that. They thought, like, who am I to say to you that you should email me and not, you know, get in touch with me with any other way? But if you ping anyone in this room, other folks that have already tested it, the moment you hit a certain wall where this is just detracting from your productive work, people start getting very aggressive very quickly in signaling what they want to do. And so we do not want to be prescriptive, and we do not want to establish, you know, this is how it's done and this is better. We just want to give you your personal opportunity to share your personal protocol and have that permission-based communication channel open up. And so we can show a few more examples and then talk you through it. And we'd love to have questions like that. Because there's a lot more research here. One other point that I'd make to wrap these two together is really interesting research has been done about the hierarchy within organizations and analyzing emails. And so the sort of famous tidbit from that study is that more powerful people have shorter, more terse emails, and they sort of say, yes, no, great, please, friend, see you then. Whereas you can imagine the young high school student looking for an internship would open with, dear sir, I love your work. Great website. Like, love it. You know, I have these following five things. Attaches my PDF and my five, you know, references, and I'm sending something in the mail. You know, and so that's really a problem, right? That's we want people to be reachable. Here's an example of one user that we haven't yet met, and I hope he's happy with us showing this online. I'll just actually take his number away because it's on the internet. But this is you know, classic behavior that we hope to see. And we hope to see more as we find this. But this is someone that said email, phone, face-to-face, SMS. But what's interesting to us is the data, and this is the research component of this project, of being able to see how people rank their preferences, and then to be able to look under the bonnet at how they then personalize them. So looking here face-to-face, schedule appointment via Tungle, which is interesting. So we're already linking onto a separate tool that shows his availability for meetings, and it's only available for meetings in Boston. Which is really helpful, right? Because we spend a lot of email time saying, I'm on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast, I'm in the city, I'm on Skype.
Right, and so the next point is, when are you in Boston? Right. This would be nice if this told me I'm actually in Boston right now if you'd like to schedule a meeting. So you can already start to see these little entry points opening up for how we might start to use this stuff. I also think what's interesting is, again, the research component is sort of, what are the norms? What are the different channels that sort of start to cluster together? Where do you fit in this spectrum, right? Like, am I a complete outlier, or are most of the people like me that are in my industry, right? And you can start to actually see, get a representation of how everyone likes to be contacted, either being personal or as a corporation. We actually do have a switch that allows you to sort of say, I'm a company or I'm a person. And so you can imagine JetBlue having a protocol that says, look, if you have this kind of problem, send us a Twitter message, because that's where we'll handle this very quickly. However, if you need to, like, deal with a refund and a major issue like that, it's probably better to email us, where you can do a long form. And so you can start to imagine these rules where, if I need to get a hold of JetBlue, I don't go to JetBlue.com. I try to just check out their protocol and see how I should get a hold of them. And it's sort of a centralized place for this.
Exactly. And the other observation, you know, if you were to graph the different mediums of communication and as they evolved over time from the penny black stamp in England, you know, the telegram, the phone, internet, Skype, cell phone, AT&T, all the way up to, it's really been speeding up a lot in the last 10 years, right? And we all know that, we all feel that, and we all right now have 3 or 5 different email addresses and Twitter accounts and whatever. And so one possible avenue for this to evolve is to think of this as, even though this storm of communication channels And now we have group messaging, for example, is the next big thing all my friends are dragging me into. But this could be an anchor. This could be a place where you say, where it's, there's social permission to say that this is my anchor, and I'll update this and tell you what I want to do and do not want to do. And maybe that could be a big value for users. And it could also, just as we mentioned, when you plug this into location and when you plug this into perhaps a group-based voting systems to establish a community protocol so people know in small groups and startups in research programs how to conduct themselves, that would help a lot. Any other examples? Or?
Yeah, actually the email we should mention. So the nice thing is that we actually offer at the top, we're not showing the edit right now, but that email signature at the top, we give a very standardized name, some sort of association, your website, and then we give you your protocol. And the idea here is to sort of get rid of those 90-line-long email footers that have quotes and different things about don't print this out on paper, think before you print, and it's like a 90, this is confidential.
Don't ever 99 cents to the Boston Marathon.
Sure, and that's, you know, more content than the actual message you got. And so we provide a very standardized protocol for the email signature that, you know, helps to sort of alleviate some of this problem as well. It's like, don't put that all in the email. You've got a site for that kind of stuff. You've got a place for that information that's much richer.
Yeah. Great. So this is one final example, and there are many that you guys can go and check out on the front page. But this is a journalist or sort of writer using the tool. And it's fascinating when I propose to people to use this. You know, you're more public figures who handle a lot of communication and who know that most of their communication details are out there. We're very quick to understand that this is very valuable. They could log it, rank it, and it was in the email signature right away. Whereas people who are maybe more private didn't have that immediate understanding of the value of this. But then looking at those examples, it's fascinating how people immediately saw this as a tool to increase their followers on Twitter or to just funnel information more efficiently into their different email accounts.
And so we've already seen that people are willing to put up their phone number, their email, that kind of stuff, knowing it's public, which means we might add in a field if you'd like to make this public. Oh, the other thing to mention is that we can actually start to make recommendations based on where you start to fit in. So almost like a template, you know, do you consider yourself a technophile? If you do this, here's typically how people do that. Here are the rules. You may not want to offer your phone number, but you may want to offer this instead. We can actually start to guide some of those cultural norms for you, so you don't need to start from scratch every time.
Exactly.
Yeah. This may be later in the talk, but I'm just curious.
What's the monetary proposition?
Right now this is a side project, and we support it.
Yeah. It's not. That's my question. I mean, it's a lovely thing. How is it non-charitably supported? Is there an advertising side? I mean, what do you have a thought about that?
I mean,
as far as the business model, we are completely interested in the academic research sites currently. I have no doubt that data is one of the most valuable assets these days, especially to companies, and this data I don't see anywhere else. So if we're able to capture a unique set of data for a lot of people, I mean, that's useful.
You've got great information on how people want to be targeted with targeted ads. It's the perfect thing.
And if you don't pay us for the service, we reserve the right to start contacting you in the way that you properly specified.
I'm just wondering, is there a self-fulfilling disincentive in this?
Yeah, I mean, I would add, though, that I was very excited to do this in the context of Berkman. And in the context, you know, Greg is at the information ecology group, right? And so, because, yes, this could be one of those, like, social media startups, yay! But we have those, and we are trying to graduate as well. And so we're very happy to keep this on the academic track and get data and research from that. Because in trying to solve this problem for ourselves, we discovered that there's a lot of sort of in the dark stabbing at data, and there's a lot of tools that make it more complicated rather than solve it. And so in that sense.
And actually, one other thought. I don't know if you guys have seen OkCupid is a dating website that actually has on their blog some of the most interesting statistics I've seen in a long time. In fact, they do some data mining, they publish them, they write it up very, very interestingly. And I mean, that alone, I would love to sort of do something like that with protocol. Like, look, here's the data, here's what we've started to notice, here are the trends of people that do this. And I mean, that kind of stuff, I think, is fascinating, both, you know, introspectively, as well as helping us understand what we're doing with all of these technological tools that we have lying all over the place, right?
Yeah,
so there's also that interest for us.
Exactly. And one idea we had was to do sort of an annual snapshot, you know, sort of protocol in the world, and sort of either aggregate all this data or have a voting system that we sort of get people to make, you know, to have a representative sample and just see how the changes over time. And I'd be interested to know and to look into the past and into the future and see what tools stick around and how we communicate differently in a work setting, in a private setting, and in person. Sorry, question back there.
Had any pushback on sort of this move of making something that's kind of ambiguous, something that's more concrete, such that, you know, if I know that your preference is email, and I'm like, great, I want to get in touch with you, I'm going to send you an email, I expect that response within 48 hours. If I don't get that response within 48 hours, there's sort of a myriad of reasons that that could be true, in that you don't want to answer my question, you don't want to deal with me, you want to think more about the topic, you don't. So there's sort of there's an ambiguity that's always sort of existed within communication channels and how we move among them. And I'm wondering sort of kind of the implications of making some of these things concrete that often we like not being concrete. Well, maybe not a hate you, but just sort of there's an ambiguity that's often valuable that you can sort of use as a technique,
right,
or as a strategy.
You can hide and you can jump between different channels.
Yeah, jump between different channels and also sort of prioritize people differently. And also sort of break that prioritization sometimes in ways that might be meaningful to a particular context or circumstances. So there's sort of there's a risk in making these things a little bit too concrete and too explicit, because you leave yourself not as much room for that experimentation.
I think that's also why we left it as open as we did, right? In mine, it says you can expect a reply within 2 days or so. I'm completely fine. I will do that. I'm really ruthless to my email, and I will probably get to you. I didn't have to say that, right? I mean, I could have just said, it's the best way to get a hold of me. You don't know expectations. Like, it might be a week, it might be 2 months. I haven't said with who, I'm leaving that open. And so you can leave as much ambiguity as you want. You may just know that I like email, and that's it. So I think it's up to you as a person to define how concrete you want to make that, how comfortable you feel doing that. And that's why it's so nice to have a personal way to do this and not like a standardized thing. It's sort of leaves open that channel for ambiguity.
I think this is really interesting. The elegance of the simplicity is not lost on me, but by the same token, it seems like so much of preferred channel is based on who this person is. Yeah. Are you my babysitter taking care of my kids right now? Are you an undergrad student who wants to interview me for a paper? I'm just wondering, is there a way to innate, how would those kinds of preferences be communicated?
So, I mean, I think we can see that direction happening where if I come to view your protocol, my contact with you is understood by the website. There's sort of a grouping, right? So like if I'm a complete stranger, I get one protocol. If I'm your mother, you know, why I would even be going to your protocol anyway is a question, but there might be something different. I think typically we're aiming this more at strangers right now. It's currently a little bit more like if you don't know me and you need to understand, my friends will never look at my protocol. Maybe as an interesting, like, what is this? But, you know, probably if you have a babysitter, you would say, look, if you need to get a hold of me, this is my number, this is how you do it. You're not going to send them to your protocol. Okay. So I think this is kind of a nice, you know.
And at the beginning,
that's how you feel about your kids.
And just to build on, at the beginning, we thought, and sort of more technical folks thought it'd be great if you can, you know, do the social thing, right? And you can really signal protocols to individuals, right, and get really granular. And that might happen many, many years from now. But I think the big insight we've sort of definitely hit on is this is for people outside of your immediate circle of trust, and people recognize it too who have used this. And you also know that people, that your colleagues or friends or family, they know not to, for example, email you at 11 a.m. when they know you're on meetings and they know that you're going to be very busy to remind you about the groceries, unless they maybe do that, I don't know. But I've coached my friends and my family to sort of follow the norms that they know that I respond well to. And so I think, yeah, this is to bring the unfamiliar into the familiar. So, John?
Is there any way so you might tie this to having different profiles on people that are related to protocols so that you could probe a profile and then get the appropriate protocol? In other words, so you may not know someone, but it may be the babysitter. I mean, this is almost like a zero-knowledge proof kind of thing, because you just know, oh, there's something there. And so, oh, it is a babysitter. Well, I'm not going to treat, and I need babysitters, and so I'm not going to treat them rudely. And there's also there's a spectrum here of sort of instrumental. These are sort of instrumental communications. And if you look at language, the huge apparatus of language is affiliative. Is this mm-hmm. sort of how you establish relationships? So this right from the beginning, establish a sort of right instrumental relationship. But over time, people, when you want to build relationships, mm-hmm. and that's a different kind of communication protocol. But I would just, so over time, there's a way of sort of linking this to some kind of profile that would then select the kind of appropriate protocol, mm-hmm. and then would be updated over a period of time.
Yep.
Hmm. And then so there are unknowns, but how do you deal with the spam question? If so, then you have the most instrumental protocol. I don't answer my mail for years. Like,
right.
If someone's not willing to share a profile with you, then you don't
right.
answer or something
right.
like that.
Yeah, I mean, the whole privacy thing and getting that granular, I think, is something we're exploring. Right now, it's very much sort of an experiment to see what this data,
right.
how it shapes up, right? And then we can start to see what the directions are available. But those are interesting ideas.
The idea of the personal data stores, actually. Mm-hmm.
Well, it does.
So yeah. you could probe a data store and find out, and you can choose a profile and build a network around it. That could be dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the different data that you're gathering, are you doing it across generations in A? B, are you doing it across individuals versus companies? Are you doing it across cultures? How are you differentiating?
So right now, it's still very basic. We just, because we want to get people onto the site, and so we don't ask too much information, and we don't want to go and find it. but I think as we open this up, and as we see greater use, we'll definitely try and build that in a way that doesn't break trust mm-hmm. with the system. So yeah, very basic, very non-personally identifiable information that will be helpful.
So you're getting it out to your friends, in a way, basically, or your colleagues.
Right.
In that
yeah. We have the personal company distinction, right? So we can obviously start to sort by what a company does versus what a person does. As far as age and ethnicity and all that stuff, we're sort of not doing that. We're actually going to sort of, I think, personally, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I want to see sort of how the clusters break up and then mm-hmm. go reverse
right,
into
right.
what the ages might be and
no,
sort
right,
of
absolutely.
What that indicates. So maybe we can do that.
That's what I was thinking.
After the fact. Mm-hmm.
David.
For research purposes, how many users do you need, and how are you going to get them?
So right now, with a private sign-up, we're very proud, I think, to have hit 300 of sort of friends and family and people that we sort of let in that didn't have too questionable protocol.by names, which has been interesting for me to sort of approve those. And,
we're actually
and
quite a bit beyond 300.
So the ones that I've... How old are we today?
No, we're like five or six.
Oh, so, and this is, sent to immediate friends at the Media Lab and the Bergman Center, so that's pretty, but a big sample thing would be, thousands, of course, and just see, I think the next step in how we develop this is the location setting and possibly embedding. So there has been this recent phenomenon of companies that you may have heard of, like About.me or Tumblr or LinkedIn or whatever, where these services try and plug into one another mm-hmm. to have a more sort of, more cohesive online identity. And I think if we design a little bit for that, we'll see even more than that.
Yeah, so there's embedding to get it out. There's also getting a hold of people that already do these rules already, convert them over into a protocol, let mm-hmm. them sort of disseminate that idea.
Yeah.
I love that you're creating a technical solution, but you're talking about culture and the human problem. That's great. One of the things that I noticed with email, and it seems like the golden era of flaming people, maybe 10, 12 years ago, has kind of gone by the wayside. Those appallingly short, really rude emails we used to get that came straight from people's id. Thank God they largely went away. But now this seems to have gone to the other side, where there's this, it's an issue around familiarity and distance and aggressiveness and politeness. And now there's a lot of assumptions being made because we can be contacted very easily, very directly, very quickly. There are expectations that people have, and then if they're not responded to, then they can get offended. It's around what you were talking about, the shared assumptions. This is like a new language. This is there. If there was a tribe of people somewhere where everybody agreed on this, that would be perfect.
Yep.
Right? But that's not the case. So what I'm wondering is if you have an interest in, or if any of your data has shown, with these protocols, is there more or less of a likelihood for people to get offended or to understand that these are shared norms and this may well be the way of the future?
It's a really nice angle that we'd like to look at. We don't have the data to start to support that yet. In fact, I still need to email people, hi, Robert. because I can't expect people to know my protocol yet, so I still end up doing these things. I think it's the problem of sort of once you get enough usage of it and it's a known thing, then you can start to see whether or not people are less offended by me being very short and terse.
And it also depends on your long view of the internet, right? And so I think many people in this room would agree that we are sort of converging on a certain set of open standards, and people cannot hide any longer. Mm-hmm. And so the flame wars of the 90s on the Yahoo mailing groups, right, has sort of gone down because, and now also what's fascinating for me to see is people in service-based industries are incredibly polite even when they are pushed to the brim because they do not want to have this sort of JetBlue Twitter flame out where they have to give the entire plane tickets because someone was really rude. And so that's interesting. It's a sort of public dimension that you can no longer hide. And there's obviously really big problems with that. And, you know, Shared Circle has written a lot about that. And but we are moving into that world. So, Joshua.
I'm a huge fan. And the reason is because it brings a lot of peace of mind. Every new technology that's introduced that allows people to communicate with us or us to communicate with people means that our identity gets increasingly fragmented, and there's always that fear that we're not using the right communication tool for the cohort that we want to associate with. So what I love about protocol is that it centralizes our communicational identity regardless of how technology changes. Right. So already I'm seeing a lot of peace of mind that you guys can possibly bring into the world. And the question I want to ask you guys is about the redefinition of identity. When you look at it in the context of universal ID, which doesn't seem to have been so successful universally, it's perhaps because the definition isn't so communicationally oriented. This suggests that our identity or our social identity is how we socialize, it's how we communicate with each other inside of some kind of social context. So I'm wondering if you are thinking at all in the direction of how identity is crafted by the communication tools that we use in any given era.
I mean, I think the argument that what we use defines us to some degree is a long, especially in human-computer interaction. I mean, the fact that I have to cram myself around a QWERTY keyboard that was designed to slow down typewriters a long time ago, that I have to use Word, which is based on legacy software, like all of these things sort of define the way we work. And so I think that there's that idea of us being shaped by what we use and our identity being embedded in these tools is critical. I don't know that socially protocol is going to define who I am as much as it's going to define the expectations and probably release a lot of that, the ambiguity and the communication issues. So I don't know. What do you think about actually identity representation through?
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to see. And I do not think that'll happen in the immediate future. But what I have noticed, sort of just looking at profiles, is that a couple of users were really proud to have very specific preferences that they use as a signaling device of how busy they are or what they're currently doing. So sort of, which was interesting, right? And it's not what we had intended, but it was interesting user behavior. And so the jury's out, but I agree with Greg that what we use does, in fact, of course, impact how we think and how we communicate and with whom we communicate, right? And so this will hopefully be a safe anchor in that ever-fluctuating space. Ethan.
So I'm a fan of the project as well, and proud to be one of the 500 up there, although I'm not sure I believe that it's going to be widely adopted. And for me, sort of the open question is this. You guys have I think, admirable, but really distinct sort of individualistic bias, which sort of says, I'm an individual, I'm going to communicate the way that I want to communicate on the tools that I want, with the rules that I want, and you know, you guys are young and smart and brilliant enough that you may well be able to assert that, but there's power dynamics associated with that, and there's also sort of social implications associated with that. You know, I spend a lot of time with the press, and I can say whatever I want about I'd rather be communicated with via email or via Twitter. They're going to call my frickin' cell phone, because that's what they do, and that's how the game works. And if you want to be quoted in the New York Times, you're going to answer the phone call as fast as you possibly can, because they have more power than you do. And I'm curious in the long run whether this idea of asserting personal communication protocols is basically a transitional moment. Are we at a moment where so many tools have just come into play that the rules are in flux? You can have those excellent New York Times articles that you showed essentially saying we just don't know how to communicate. Are we going to centralize on a new set of socially acceptable protocols? Or, as you guys seem to be implying, are we going to simply fragment to a point where before I call Clip, I'm going to want to go and figure out exactly what his protocol is, because that becomes the polite thing to do. Do we hit a meta protocol, or are we going to reconverge at some point on what those rules are again?
Well, I mean, I think, okay, so if we look at the history of communication preferences, you know, I don't know if one communication tool that showed up erased all the other ones, right? I mean, I still have to mail a check to my landlord. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Twitter didn't have any effect on that. The phone didn't have any effect on that. Like, that's still there, and I still have to do that. In fact, I still have to fax over non-disclosure agreements with my signature on it, because some people don't realize that fax is the same as email. And so it's sort of like, you know, I don't know that we're going to have, we're ever going to be at a point where we're going to come to sort of a singularity of communication preference that represents everything, and we never need this again. At the same time, I agree that it's a transitional thing. I think that we're an explosion of communication preferences. This will probably boil down to something that's a smaller set, mm-hmm. probably more like the sets that we're seeing in these guys, right? Like 4 to 5 things, and not the 900 on the other side. So yes, it's a transitional thing. I also think that it's going to help us probably define what makes sense as tools. It's also going to help us realize what are the best methods, what makes sense for us as a culture in that way. So I guess yes and no.
And just one thought to that, even though that's a great question, great answer. And as you yourself mentioned to me that, you know, you're still big on radio, right? And radio is still very big in the world, right? And so technologies rarely replace one another entirely, as Greg said, but there's a splintering effect, right? And I think that'd be interesting to catalog and to have this be a bridge for that phenomenon. And secondly, it'd be great if everyone could be on protocol that I interact with and that the world interacts with, but that would probably not happen in the immediate future. But I do see perhaps, similar to how LinkedIn at the beginning was really for people in a specific industries or area, that people who are journalists, high transaction communicators would use it. And it would be sort of an assumption that if you need to be found, that you would have something on you, like if you are a public figure that needs to have public dialogue, perhaps in the same way that all these famous Twitter folks now, who's the mayor from New Jersey or Cory Booker? You know what he did there was fascinating, right? So there we go.
And the reason I bring this up is that you can start to see Reportive is this wonderful thing that's an extension for Gmail. I don't know if any of you guys have used it, but it's great. Basically, whenever I have an email open, it will go and fetch information about that person for me and show it next to the email. So their Twitter account, their LinkedIn, you know, their latest
Skype,
Twitter posts, which is fantastic because now I get all the information. I think we're starting to see that identity combining, to go back to the question earlier, identity combining with communication preferences. So you can imagine protocol jumping in there, right? Very quickly. Soon. I mean, I probably should email these guys and ask them to do it. But
I know these guys. So, Joseph, you end up, and then I want to go to...
So I was just going to note that it seems that your greatest motivation is to create a palette towards guilt. I don't want people to think I'm rude. I don't want to feel anxious. And as someone that created a protocol in the late 90s about how I work, and for example, if someone got offended, I specified some URLs, because I said, on this date, you said this, and then here's the thing, and they think I'm getting all technical, and that's just the way I worked. I created a protocol. I did feel a little less guilt and anxiety, but I don't know if anyone actually referred to it before they contacted me, or I affected the way people interact with me. So, for example, if you wanted to write to me, and I say, I want very long personal emails with honorariums and salutations, and would you actually abide by that if you needed to? So it
depends
way,
on how well I know you, right?
And on the power relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
of course. I mean, I think you're definitely right, and there's a difference between the product now.
So my point is given that I'm a geek, I just think this is a geeky way to sort of deal with some of the social anxieties that geeks tend to have. And
thank you.
It might deal with your guilt, but I don't know. You know what will come out of it.
So I think a good issue with that is this two-step process that we're all mentioning, which is I want to contact somebody, let me figure out the protocol, then let me figure out how to contact them. I think the future would obviously collapse all of that into I want to contact them, the system figures out what makes sense, right? It offers something in a way that I don't need to worry about putting in the contact information. It just sort of shapes that interaction better for us. So as opposed to relying on people doing that, that would be one option.
Yeah. And another use case is when people do become annoying, and this is again a power relationship thing, but when students G-chat me, which is inappropriate at midnight, when you know I'm a teaching fellow and not a friend, I just say protocol device at Hugo, and then they go there, and it's immediately, oh, sorry, and I get an email next morning, right? And so that's interesting, is how you enforce it. The sort of third step is you need to be consistent, and I did not reply to John's email within 48 hours, as I said I would, right? And so that was, I broke integrity there, right? And so now so it's basically how you behave primes how people behave towards you, right? So a few other questions?
Oh, this is just a comment, and it's sort of ha-ha funny, but sort of serious in that it seems like there has to be a whole brand of new psychology and psychologists that are dealing with these issues around when something is ambiguous, what does it mean, and does it mean somebody hates me, does it mean this, does it mean this,
and
like a whole other level that you can't get your head around when somebody's not replying to you and following these protocols. And right. I mean, it's kind of funny, but in some ways it's necessary to figure out how to work with this ambiguity.
Yeah, how to understand the modern workplace. You do end up for a while, and then, sorry, sir.
I just want to ask about the cultural legitimacy of communication platforms. So, like, when you don't necessarily know someone, and you're saying that it's primarily targeted at strangers, what I normally do is probably type their name in Google and maybe email address or homepage or something like that, and then I would directly find their kind of like primary facing piece of information online. So how do you get protocol to become that foremost place of information where I would go to contact X person or Y person? Especially when you're talking about different generations or different communities or stuff like that. Cause
different
like,
devices. Different.
Yeah, I mean, like, when you're talking about teenagers, it's kind of like an assumption that you go straight to Facebook. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about generally adults, it's the assumption that you go directly to email first. Mm-hmm. Above any other kind of more personal communication. So, like, how do you push protocol to become that initial channel?
I mean, I think we have embedding was our first idea for the people that if you have a web page, I can embed my protocol on it. Facebook can have it as a plugin. I mean, I think all these ways to sort of disseminate that information digitally is actually fairly easy if people like it, right? There's lots of ways to embed things. As far as pushing it back to people that are sort of outside that loop, that is a very difficult question, right? If you don't have an online presence and you don't really represent yourself that way, then protocol is difficult. I don't know that we actually push that.
Well, yeah,
that
and
way.
Then in some ways, if you guys tell us this is a useful tool and that if we define very clearly who will be good users for this, then we can develop this like we would for a product and use, develop partnerships with people like Reportive and other folks and definitely get it up there. But I think one thing is the neutrality, right? So right now, for instance, Google Pages, well, there is a Google profile. There's different companies have profiles, but we want to be between all these channels and just be sort of the Switzerland, if you will, of of communication, like protocols. So in the back, and the professor,
you know. There's a huge need for this and a great business, eventually, this, and there's value for people on the people on the other side of this.
Mm-hmm.
So there are profitable business models here. But if you step back, you show up here at the front of the room with self-declared protocols. Hugo is your protocol, and Greg is you, which comes from back at the time when we were only face-to-face, and we probably had semantic words. What's missing here, and this is what the conversation is we've gotten very porous boundaries or collapsed boundaries on all these mechanisms here, which are digital, which allow every student you've ever known to come crashing in on you any time, day or night, and anybody else. And the need is there. And it's an addition to what you've got started here. I got business where I want people to self-declare what subjects they're interested in, because I can give them higher value if they tell me they're interested in day trips about art museums than ones to go see lighthouses. And so I believe that all the stuff that's going on where people are implicitly mining about me based upon what words I write, I'm almost livid about it, because I'd rather tell them mostly what I'm interested in. And I believe there's a massive need here, and there will be, somebody will do this, software as a service, where I can say, you're going to have to page through this to get to me, because it will be that valuable, and it will be my smart active filter.
Hmm. Do you want to speak to the data?
I think that idea of currently it's this, and there's a website you go to, it's optional, and then you contact someone. I think, again, combining that into a single thing where the technology acts as sort of a linebacker for you, that's sort of like, okay, well, you know, somebody wants to text me, it hits my protocol, and there's filtering there that goes on. That.
So I either want somebody to supply this so I can partner with them, or I want to get it started, and I want to get money for it.
So thank you for the validation. we appreciate that. But
we'll get some VC money.
on it. But one word that you didn't mention that I've not heard mentioned here today that I think is really important is reputation, right? And so, you know, when we lived long ago in small environments and small groups, reputation mattered, right? Because it impacted your status and it impacted your ability to trade and transact and basically affect your goals and increase your inclusive fitness, right? And today, in the broader world, there was a sort of breakdown of people moving around a lot and people being able to reinvent themselves many times. And as the internet goes into its next phase, what sort of Hoffman and O'Reilly and those guys call Web 3.0, but I didn't say that, I think reputation and data will matter immensely. And so to both of these questions, why would someone listen to me? Because, Ethan, I think if the New York Times reporter annoys you when you're with your family by calling you on a Sunday, you're going to be polite because you're a polite guy, and you're going to say, I'm going to help you this time, but next time I'm going to give preference to the Wall Street Journal. Right? No?
I'm just telling you how it is.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
The press may be an exception.
A lot of this just comes down to power.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, if like someone really wants to have a conversation with you under certain circumstances and they have power over you, they're going to do it.
Yeah. Bill Gates calls, I'll probably pick up, right? Like, I mean, there's a moment where, even if you're sleeping, there's really a point at which that protocol is going to break. And I think that those are extreme power situations, and that's definitely... Yeah.
And that's okay. But I think the point about reputation does matter, and that this will increase that. The lady in the back... sorry, Professor Goodenough, I had to stand up for a while.
Two things. One... your embedding is a nice idea. I'm envisioning it into my institutional websites, you know, for places. One place you might try and do it is if, particularly if you get some kind of cute logo that could just go next to everybody's name on their personal websites. Yep. And if you could sell it to places like Harvard to put next to their IDs at Berkman or something like that.
That's our current cute logo.
We'll increase the but the idea of code.
Exactly. So people come to understand. Oh, I found them on their webpage.
Right.
You know, how do I actually get in touch and I can click through?
I got it.
Different question. I don't think you solve the problem with this. I think you all you really do is you increase the velocity, which is actually the problem. The problem is one way to restate the problem is that all of this is now so cheap. There's no barrier. There's no barrier on the sender side to communication. You know, if you have to pay, you know, whatever it is for a stamp, 48 cents for a stamp, you know, that's a barrier. You got to think about it. You got none of this. There's no marginal cost other than my own little bit of time to try and do anything. Is there anybody out there talking about, it's been in the back of my head for a bit, I'm sure it's not, other people's heads, how do you put actual costs on email? I mean, you know, I don't want to have them to tell me one. I want to charge them $10 to get to me. And if it's worth $10, let's send a $10 contribution to Ethan's charity. You know, I don't care, but if there's an actual cost, a barrier to getting to me, then we'll sort out a bunch of these things. And the student trying to get you at midnight, if you've got a post midnight $5 charge to actually tweet you, you know, or whatever it is, you know, get in touch with you in some fashion. You know, then you've got a motivation ticket that slows this velocity and controls it and makes people think, do I really need to do this? Rather than just dumping wheelbarrows of contact on.
Right. I mean, so there's two responses to that. One is, as we said, we see protocol as eventually taking that position, as being the barrier, being the one that costs. The problem with money and doing monetarily is obviously it's class-based. If I have plenty of money, what does it matter to me? If I'm the New York Times, I'm still going to, like, now I just have $50, $100. The monetary benefit may or may not work.
It will work. It will just discriminate in ways that will be invidious.
Right. So maybe
virtual.
That's...
Yeah. But it can be virtual money.
Have tried that way. So Bill Gates famously, and many others, trying to sort of have like a 1 cent or a tenth of a cent sort of barrier, purely to stop the spammers, right?
Right,
and,
right?
And not you and me as the spammers, right? And there's various reasons why that is, you know, we do not use that today. And I'm sure that you know more examples of ways that people try to sort of arbitrarily assign a cost to communication. But I think, you know, since we're the small guys here, I think if we can sort of be, that wall in between. Right. That's a good place to start.
So I'll give a use case of what I was talking about with some guys from Cisco the other day. There's a lot of things where they've tried to intelligently create these networks that properly route things, understand context, and escalate properly as needed. The idea here that, let's say, my good friend Aaron, who's in California right now, I need to get a hold of him. What I might say is, hey, do you have time to talk, right? I would sort of try to assert whether or not there's a ability to talk to me then. It'd be nice if I could sort of ping protocol and say, hey, I need to get a hold of Aaron. Protocol can sort of see where he is, what he's up to, what his preferences are, right? Look at our history together and say, well, you guys typically talk on the phone. Aaron's at a loud restaurant right now. It's not really going to work out. So it pings him and says, hey, Greg wants to get a hold of you. If it's a random student trying to chat with me at midnight, goes through protocol and says, you're not really on this like white list and you're trying a communication at the wrong time based on protocol, so auto responds to that person. And the cost isn't really, there's no cost, but there's no guarantee of success of getting through. So I think that creating that filter might be an interesting way to solve that issue. Not solve, but improve.
Yeah, we're almost running out of time, so I want to do the last few questions so Amar doesn't have to close us down. And also to say that we love students and we love teaching, and Hulk is a great place for teaching. If that's one point we're losing, please.
So one thing that, and this had nothing to do with all these choices, it had to do merely with telephones, which is it used to be easy. I knew when midnight was, or I knew when 10 o'clock was. I don't know that anymore. My wife could be in Beijing for all I know. On the other hand, you may not want to let people know what time zone you're in. So one thing that would be nice is to have an abstraction layer where you can change the order based on time without the person who's seeing the protocol knowing why or what that change is. For example, and you might not have thought about it because you guys don't like telephones, but some people don't mind telephones as a way of getting hold of them. So it might be nice to say, here's the time zone I'm in, and during these hours, this is the order I want, and at these hours, I want to swap my order around.
That's a great
because,
idea.
And I've always wondered how, with cell phones, you hide the fact that you're not necessarily home, but give people some warning that you'd rather not be called at what seems like a perfectly reasonable time for them.
So I think that's... So
and
there's...
I should... One last thing is the answer to why don't you shut off the ringer is maybe it is my wife calling me in an emergency. Yeah, so right. I don't shut off the ringer, but I would like to discourage calls at certain times. So that's something that I think would be a nice to abstract behind...
Definitely. So, I mean, there's location, there's time, there's who's trying to contact you. There's all these nice levels of abstraction. The issue with that, obviously, is that you get into very granular power user features and the more of like, well, I'm okay from this hour to this half hour. And then, so we're sort of starting with a broad level. But I think all of these abstraction layers are a good idea, interesting, definitely something we want to explore. So,
David?
So I'm not as sure as I think the three of you are whether things are going to consolidate, whether the norms are going to consolidate, because while there is, I think, a natural tendency for that to happen, it's the global range of anybody can get in touch with you and you don't know what country, what their local community norms are. And so there is, I think, a need for, and you're seeing, increasingly explicit metadata about your norms, things we don't have to tell... I don't tell Ethan, don't call me after midnight because, you know, we share a community, but I might have to tell somebody else. So there very likely will be, I think, an increase in the need for explicit metadata. And I want to give you a suggestion, which is we also need that for IP issues. And so Creative Commons comes along, and not only does it have a set of profiles, an increasingly, you know, small set of them, but they also have a nice little marker that you can put in that doesn't make any sense unless you know what it is, but you can click on it and find out, and you may be intrigued by looking at it and saying, what is this one? And you click on it and find out. So the same way, instead of having a four squares and click on it, you might want to take what is the most salient single piece of information, which is here's my preferred order for generally for how to be preferred. Email first, then instant messaging, then SMS. Make a little graphic that lists that. Let us put it into... on our institution's web pages, as Oliver said, or at the bottom in our SIG. This is just as Creative Commons does, as a way of propagating it.
Yeah, I think the embedded one is, our idea was to sort of make several layers. One is you could just have an icon. One you could actually embed with just the options that dynamically updates on your site. The other is to have with your rules in case those are most important. So you could give as much or as little information in your embedding as you want. So it's not just an icon. Sitting there.
I guess I push for just the icon on the ground. It's easier to market one thing than three. But.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good feedback. Thanks, David.
I should just follow up to that. Maybe instead of four squares, have a mail thing, a phone, like a text thing, something like that, you mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sorry, we missed you earlier.
Yeah, please. So one was, I think this the power model is very interesting here. I mean, really, the model is that you're trying to get in touch with me, therefore I have the right to tell you how to do that. I think another interesting model to look to think about would be a more kind of equivalent where here's mine, here's yours, and then this the protocol is kind of suggesting where do we meet in the middle. So that might be something interesting.
Yeah, where, when, yeah.
Oh, you're okay. And just the last thing is in the film, the video that you showed at the beginning, it was a bunch of kind of here's the problem, email over, you know, too many emails, too many. And one of the stats, I think, was the percent of SNSs with more women than men. Did anyone else?
That was a reference to.
Yeah, what? How is. I'm just.
And it was, I think, social networking sites as well. That was the main.
But that was more women discreet.
How is that?
Like, we have 5 social networking sites. 3 of them have 1 more women than they have men. Or is it that, like, 84% of the population of social networking sites is female? Which one of those was it?
So, you guys could look at the video. I think that was sort of taken off of the sort of census that one of the major think tanks for the internet did in 2010. And I can send that out, and I think it's...
Yeah, listed. I was just curious. I mean, because it seemed all about the problems of being overwhelmed. Is it that women are talking too much about sites? I mean,
not at all the gender comment. I think we cut it off 3 seconds too late. But the interesting thing is, there's a lot of fascinating research. An OkCupid blog is one example of how different genders, different age groups, different cultures use these different tools, and this is a mitigator for that. Any other questions?
Just one quick comment. We talked a lot about the granularity of there's all these different types of people and how they get in touch with us, students versus family versus all these other people. I wonder if a low hanging fruit wouldn't be to just take some kind of personal information, like a question or, some type of password where you've just got the people who you know you want to talk to and the people that you know you can wait to talk to, and just kind of have at least 2 profiles to get some kind of
benefit out of. I mean, so my personal friends would have a key that they can get a hold of me?
Right, or they know your last name.
You kind of get into the DRM problem that way, though. Then it's like you try to create a barrier, and someone learns to bypass it, and then you create a better barrier. And then eventually, I almost feel like the more implicit we can solve that and define the tool as what it's for and what it's not for, then, not sending my friends to my protocol is probably my preferred way. You just don't need to do that if I'm your friend.
How do you encourage people to update? So, if you had created this, maybe 5 years ago, I'm sure that MySpace would probably have been up there. And then, come today, how many people would still have MySpace as one of their primary contacts? And how many people would have updated it to now to replace MySpace since no one really uses it anymore?
Yeah, well, I think that these services are going to be less and less websites that you go to update. I mean, I don't want to do that with my resume. I don't want to do that with lots of things, right? I mean, there should be sort of a centralized point where I can manage the stuff. And I think that would be the direction we'd go, where protocol is part of your identity, and it's not a matter of remembering a website to go to, but in the way RSS changed from us going to a bunch of websites to sort of bringing all that information to us. You can see that with identity happening as well, so it would be less of a chore. You just might see, oh, MySpace, now I don't use that anymore. Done. It's in the tool you're using. It's in Gmail. It's in whatever your communication.
And what I've seen with some of the users, if they use this actively and they experience the impact of the tool, they start playing with it a lot, right? And so if someone said, oh, I'm emailing you as you asked with an active subject line, then you're like, oh, wow, that means so much to me. Look to my protocol. And then you go back to it, and you actually tweak it, and you notice that it has an impact. And so that's one of the sort of scale things, right? If we hit a larger scale, I think people will pay more attention to it, and they comment on it. It become a community effect, and that could be interesting and solve some of those problems.
I think we have 1 minute for...
Yeah. So I was thinking more about the idea of privacy. Traditionally, the idea of privacy has been that you have the right to be left alone, and that is no longer true. People are more concerned with how much information is out there about me and how can I control that, because that's increasingly more powerful. And you seem, and this is what I guess where my question lies, you seem to adopt somewhat of a technological determinist stance, where you're saying technology drives history, technology will determine our social norms. Is that what you're insinuating? Is that what you're kind of driving at? Look, we have all these, you know, technological applications. There are going to be many more. We're going to need to establish a protocol so we can be connected to the external world. Is that what you're kind of leaning towards?
I don't think we have made a decision as to sort of the long-term philosophical implications and sort of where we put our bets, I think. But what I would say, though, is, you know, from our conversations and our collaboration and from our individual work, we definitely have a strong view and determination, both professionally and personally, to make technology work with humans. And so that's why we think very carefully about things like privacy. And so I don't know if that's a good enough answer. But
I don't think it's the sole determining character. I don't think technology is like what is the defining thing. But I don't think we can argue that technology is not a huge influence on a lot of our lives. I mean, it is there. And so we either just let it run wild or we try to sort of set some guidelines around it. And I think there are other properties that are going to define, you know, what you're talking about. But we can't ignore technology. And this is just sort of a little gate around that channel that exists.
That's a great question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.